Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the July 22nd, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Mourning and pleas for unity in Dallas. What happened? President Obama made an impassioned plea for Americans to reject despair and overcome their racial divisions this week as he paid tribute to five police officers shot dead by a black sniper in downtown Dallas. Micah Johnson, a 25-year-old Army veteran, opened fire from the upper levels of a parking garage last Thursday evening during a peaceful Black Lives Matter protest over the fatal police shootings of two black men in Louisiana and Minnesota. As officers helped protesters scramble for cover and tried to rescue their fallen comrades, Johnson picked them off with a semi-automatic assault rifle. In addition to the five slain, seven officers and two civilians were wounded. Police eventually cornered Johnson, and when he refused to surrender, they used a bomb carried by a robot to kill him. Dallas Police Chief David Brown said Johnson told negotiators he was angry about police killings of black men and wanted to kill white people, especially white officers. At Johnson's home outside Dallas, investigators found bomb-making materials, more weapons, and a personal journal containing combat tactics. Police believe he'd been planning a larger attack until the protest march gave him an opportunity to target many cops in one place. Johnson had been in the Army Reserve until 2014, when he was sent home from Afghanistan for stealing a female soldier's underwear. He subsequently began following radical black nationalist groups on social media. Presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump accused the Black Lives Matter movement of dividing America and called for law and order. But speaking at a memorial service for their slain officers in Dallas, Obama insisted Americans are not as divided as we seem. Former President George W. Bush and his wife stood in solidarity with the president and his wife and called on Americans to bridge their divisions by practicing empathy. Too often we judge other groups by their worst examples, Bush said, while judging ourselves by our best intentions. What the editorial said. Obama's speech was the perfect response to this moment of profound division and despair, said the New York Times. He praised the police for their bravery, noting that officers under fire in Dallas didn't hesitate to protect protesters, black or white, and admonished Black Lives Matter protesters to recognize that most cops perform their jobs valiantly and fairly. But he also implored white Americans to acknowledge that racial bias in policing remains a problem, and that black men killed in Louisiana and Minnesota had families who loved them too. It's time to lower the temperature in the debate over race and policing, said NationalReview.com. Without waiting for the facts of the shootings in Louisiana and Minnesota, Black Lives Matter immediately labeled killings as murder and spoke of an epidemic of police violence. These kinds of knee-jerk reactions incite violence, putting cops at risk. Both sides are guilty of fanning the flames, said USA Today. The head of the National Association of Police Organizations directly blamed Obama for a war on cops for simply acknowledging the legitimate grievances of black communities. It's just not true that if you believe black lives matter, you cannot believe blue lives matter too. What the columnist said. Black Lives Matter is playing a dangerous double game, said David French in NationalReview.com. The peaceful activists in the movement are asking that black lives also matter, that black people be treated with equal dignity, and that police violence and abuse be fairly investigated and prosecuted, all worthy goals. But radicals in the group's leadership have spent 2 years advancing narratives every bit as inflammatory as the worst white nationalist rhetoric. In recent days alone, black protesters have shot at cops, barged into one cop's home, and attacked cops with rocks and bottles and dropped a concrete block on a cop's head. Don't blame millions of protesters for the actions of a few idiots, said Goldie Taylor in thedailybeast.com. For the millennial generation, Black Lives Matter is our civil rights movement. All we want is equal recognition and protection under the law. And like our grandparents before us, we're using nonviolent protest and civil disobedience to advance our ideals. The recent horror show of violence may make it feel as if America is coming apart, as the nation did in 1968, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. But we're not. Most of the protests are civil, and prominent white conservatives are finally conceding the pervasiveness of police brutality. In 1968, wars, assassinations, and riots brought our country to its knees in a way that's still hard to fathom. A sad irony is that Dallas Police Department is one of the nation's most humane, said Mark Ambinder in USA Today. Under the highly impressive Police Chief Brown, all officers have received extensive training in de-escalating confrontations instead of meeting every threat with force, and in using non-lethal force instead of shooting. The result? There were only 20 complaints about over-aggressive policing last year, compared with 209 in 2009. Police shootings were down 40% in 2015, assaults on officers down 30%. This type of training is the best way to ensure that all lives matter. Our controversy of the week, on the same general topic, police. Are black men dying because of racial bias? Black Lives Matter, said Roxanne Gay in NYTimes.com, and then in an instant they don't. In Baton Rouge last week, Alton Sterling, 37, was selling CDs outside a convenience store when two police officers arrived. They wrestled him onto the hood of a car and tasered him. And as they held him on the ground, one officer fired at least 4 shots into Sterling's chest, killing him. The police claimed Sterling was reaching for a gun, but a cell phone video of the encounter seemed to show the cops taking the gun from his pocket after they shot him. Then came Philando Castile, said Michael Eric Dyson in the New York Times. Pulled over in suburban Minnesota, apparently because his wide-set nose resembled that of a robbery suspect, Castile, 32, informed Officer Geronimo Yanez that he had a registered firearm in the car, and then, when Castile reached for his driver's license as instructed, Yanez panicked and shot him. From the passenger seat, Castile's girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, broadcast his death live on Facebook. Once again, we've been reminded of the justifiable terror black people feel every time they encounter police. At any moment, a blue-clad officer with a gun could swoop down on us and snatch our lives from us and say that it was because we were selling cigarettes or compact discs or speaking too abrasively. Sorry, but the notion that cops are massacring blacks has no connection to reality, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. A new Harvard University study by an African-American researcher finds that black people are actually no more likely to be shot than white people in the course of an encounter with police. That doesn't mean that there are no rogue shooters wearing police uniforms or that racism must be dismissed as an issue not worth addressing. but the assumption upon which Black Lives Matter is based is false. The Harvard study doesn't prove that at all, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com. The researchers studied data from only 10 police departments that agreed to cooperate, not the whole nation. More importantly, the study found that blacks were no more likely to be shot by police once they were stopped by cops, and doesn't address whether people of color are being stopped excessively in the first place. In much of the country, they certainly are. In Ferguson, Missouri, for example, blacks made up 67% of the population, but 93% of arrests and 85% of traffic stops. Let's also not minimize the overt racism the study did find, said Chauncey Alcorn in Fortune.com. If the person who is stopped by the cops is black, police are 24% more likely to point their guns and 18% more likely to use physical force than with whites. So why are some conservatives insisting there is no racial bias in policing? Whites and blacks simply have very different experiences in dealing with police, said Leon Wolf in RedState.com. The vast majority of cops are true professionals, but as innumerable cell phone videos have shown us, some treat black people with hostility and or fear. The shootings of Sterling and Castile look bad, very bad, and resemble other police killings of black men in which officers have skated either scot-free or with a slap on the wrist. If that doesn't bother you, it's because you assume, probably correctly, that a cop will never stop you, throw you on the ground, or shoot you simply because of your skin color. It was a good week for everyone who needs more time. After NASA announced that a leap second will be added to the world's official clocks at 11:59:59 on New Year's Eve this year, an adjustment meant to keep atomic clocks in sync with the Earth's rotation. It was a good week for fish stories after a six-year-old boy hooked a great white shark while fishing with his father off Cape Cod, Massachusetts, fighting the 12-foot predator for an hour before cutting it free. Next time, said Blake White, he'll try to catch something a little bit smaller. It was a good week for thinking out of the box after a group of inmates at a Texas jail broke out of a confinement area to help save a guard who was suffering a heart attack. "We were worried they were going to come with guns drawn on us," inmate Nick Kelton said. But it was a bad week for authors after researchers at MIT revealed that virtually every story in human literature, from King Lear to The Hangover, is based on one of just six core plots, which form the building blocks of complex narratives. It was a bad week for automation after a toddler at a California shopping mall was knocked down and run over by a 300-pound security robot. "The 16-month-old boy wasn't badly hurt," said his mother, Tiffany Ting, "but he was crying like crazy." And it was a bad week for chasing phantoms after a Georgia woman became trapped in a graveyard while playing Pokemon Go, the gaming craze that requires user to track down virtual characters in real-world locations. "The gate is blanking closed," the indignant woman told a 911 dispatcher. "This is not cool." We're on the briefing page now. Olympic doping. Russia's entire track and field team has been banned from the Rio Olympics. Do other athletes dope too? Why were the Russians banned? Investigators found that Russia had for many years been running a massive state-sponsored doping program for its athletes. The allegations first came to light in a 2014 German TV documentary in which whistleblowers claimed 99% of Russian athletes used banned substances and that Russian officials both supplied the drugs and colluded with doping control officials to cover up failed tests. One athlete said she had paid the Russian Athletics Federation $450,000 to keep secret a positive test. In a devastating report last year, investigators for the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, concluded that Russia had been running a state-supported doping program dating back to at least the 2008 Beijing Olympics. It alleged that the country's anti-doping agency, with the help of the FSB, Russia's secret security services, routinely gave athletes advance notice of tests, bullied doping testers and their families, and intentionally destroyed positive test samples. "It's worse than we thought," said Dick Pound, the report's author. "This is an old attitude from the Cold War days." Has Russia admitted any wrongdoing? Not really. Sports Minister Vitaly Mutko apologized for the failures of Russia's anti-doping system, but he blamed individual athletes and refused to admit any state involvement. Dr. Grigory Rodchiknov, the former director of Russia's main anti-doping laboratory, painted a very different picture. Now in hiding in the U.S., Rodchiknov revealed that at the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, a secret lab was set up in the room next to the sealed-off WADA testing area. At night, Russian anti-doping officials passed athletes' urine samples through a tiny hole in the wall to the secret lab. The tainted samples were then replaced with clean urine and returned through the hole to the testing area. Russia topped the medal count in Sochi after having finished 11th in the previous Winter Olympics in Vancouver. How prevalent is doping? Russia isn't the first country with a state-sponsored drug program. In the 1970s and 80s, the communist regime in East Germany forced as many as 10,000 athletes, many without their knowledge, to take anabolic steroids, a synthetic version of the male sex hormone testosterone. These drugs, which are still the most popular form of doping today, enable athletes to train harder, recover faster, and build more muscle. But they had a devastating effect on East Germany's female athletes, who suffered from side effects including unusual hair growth, deepened voices, and fertility issues. Several Olympic athletes, mainly weightlifters, were caught for steroid abuse during the 1970s and early 80s, but the issue really came to the public's attention when Canadian sprinter Ben Johnson was stripped of his gold medal at the 1988 Seoul Olympics after a positive test. What other drugs do athletes use? Commonly used banned substances, including HGH, human growth hormone, which helps build and repair muscle, and EPO, erythropoietin, which raises the red blood cell count and increases endurance and power. Athletes also use stimulants to reduce fatigue and diuretics to mask the presence of other drugs. A more extreme technique, one that was employed by the disgraced seven-time Tour de France winner Lance Armstrong, is to have a blood transfusion before competing to increase endurance. How do athletes escape detection? They play an ongoing game of cat and mouse with anti-doping authorities. Anti-doping agencies are constantly trying to identify performance-enhancing drugs, PEDs, and tests for them, while rogue scientists are always developing new ones. And while all athletes are subject to random testing at international events, the system is far from foolproof. Determined cheaters often find excuses to delay tests until banned substances leave their bodies. Several have been caught trying to smuggle in clean urine. Many employ doping experts who show them how to cycle on and off PEDs to reduce the chance of getting caught. Can the system be improved? One of the biggest developments in recent years was the 2009 introduction of the Athlete Biological Passport, a constantly updated record of an athlete's physiological condition, including his or her red blood cell count and testosterone level. This electronic document is designed to detect the effects of banned substances rather than the drug itself. But athletes are getting around that by microdosing, taking steroids and EPO in smaller quantities more regularly rather than in big doses. The performance-enhancing benefits are subtler, but can still mean the difference between winning and losing. And microdosing drastically reduces the risk of being caught. Microdosing can take an athlete from 10th place to 1st place, said Max Cobb, director of the U.S. Biathlon. But you're no longer seeing those extraordinary, oh my God, how did that guy finish 2 minutes faster moments. Anonymous athlete surveys suggest that from 14 to 39% of competitors still use PEDs, yet only 1 to 2% a year fail a drug test. Moving on to the columns now, we'll take two from the U.S. The first, using robots to kill suspects. For the first time in history, police have used a robot to remotely kill a criminal suspect, said David Graham. Dallas Police Chief David Brown said, "We saw no other option than to kill shooting suspect Micah Xavier Johnson last week with a pound of C4 explosives delivered by a rolling robot. Johnson was refusing to surrender and threatening to kill more police officers." While few people are second-guessing Brown's decision, the use of robots to deliver lethal force raises questions about how this technology will be deployed in other cases. In the past, cops have often been accused of being too quick to use new technology like the taser when they would be better served to de-escalate. Robots will present similar temptations. Imagine a circumstance, for example, where an armed suspect is holed up but not actively firing or threatening anyone. Would frustrated police send in a robot to kill him rather than trying to talk him out, since there would be less danger to officers? Do we want police to rely on robots the way the military has come to rely on drones to deliver death from afar? A new frontier has been opened in policing, and it will lead to an intense ethical debate. Why are so many voters independent? If you're a political independent like me, you'll probably feel left out when the Republicans and Democrats hold their conventions, said Timothy Egan. A recent Pew Research poll found that 39% of Americans identify as independents, more than the percentages who identify as Democrats or Republicans. These contrarians have no political place to call home because their views don't fall into conventional boxes. They may think, for example, that Democrats need to get tough with unions that protect bad teachers, reject the far-left PC censors who are enemies of free speech, and start advocating for working-class Americans instead of corporate interest. Yet the same voters are horrified by Republican intransigence on climate change and gun control and the ravings of that bombastic would-be tyrant, Donald Trump. In other words, there's room for nuance in their thinking. The two major parties have failed these voters miserably, focusing on the kind of politics in which attacking the opponent's party is the primary goal. A recent Gallup poll found that 58% of voters said a third party was needed because Republicans and Democrats do such a poor job representing average Americans. When will the parties get that message? From the United Kingdom, a new Iron Lady Prime Minister. It was like something from an action movie, the heroine standing alone, unharmed and victorious, with bodies strewn all around her, said former UK Foreign Secretary William Hague in the Daily Telegraph. Home Secretary Theresa May this week replaced the outgoing David Cameron as head of the ruling Conservative Party, becoming Britain's second woman prime minister, after backstabbing and unfortunate comments destroyed her key rivals' campaigns. Her last challenger, Energy Minister Andrea Leadsom, withdrew from the race after being bombarded with criticism for suggesting that, as a mother, she was a better candidate than the childless May. So our new prime minister has taken office rather by default, with many people feeling they have not had time or chance to come to know her. Let me reassure them. I served with May in Parliament for 17 years, and I know her to be tough and fair. As Home Secretary, she stood up to the U.S. and refused to extradite a man with Asperger's who had hacked the Pentagon's computers. And she defied the European Union and deported the radical Islamist cleric Abu Qatada to his native Jordan. She thinks carefully before making decisions and then defends them steadfastly. The ideal leader to negotiate Britain's exit from the EU. The stern, unsmiling May will inevitably be compared to Margaret Thatcher, Britain's first female prime minister, said Melanie McDonough in the London Evening Standard. Like Thatcher, May is not notably feminist, but unlike Thatcher, she is no economic ideologue. A vicar's daughter, May is guided by her Christianity, a stolid Anglicanism that underpins everything she does. She famously critiqued her own Tories for being the nasty party and has promised a kinder, gentler conservatism that works for everyone, not just the privileged few. Rather than cutthroat capitalism, she advocates cooperation, including German-style worker representation on company boards. But she has no mandate to do any of that, said the Daily Mirror in an editorial. Nobody voted for Prime Minister May. She was selected by a handful of Conservative members of Parliament, representing just 0.0004% of the 44.7 million Britons on the electoral roll. Such a narrow franchise might be acceptable in North Korea or Saudi Arabia, but here it is rightly seen as an outrageous power grab by a political elite. May claims she won't call an early election, but the people must insist on one. The Tories won power under Cameron, not May, and she must fight and win her own election rather than piggybacking on his. No, Britain needs certainty and stability now above all, said Max Hastings in the Daily Mail. The Brexit negotiations ahead of us will be grueling, and although May wanted the UK to stay in the EU, she has pledged to see those talks through. May is not flashy or charismatic, but she is sensible and competent, and that's sufficient. We have had enough excitement. And now the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, Kim Jong-un's American Relatives. Nearly two decades ago, the aunt and uncle of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un quietly defected to the U.S. Journalist Anna Fifield tracks them down to find out why they now want to reconnect with their dictator nephew. Wandering through Times Square, past the naked cowboy and the ticket touts, she could be any immigrant trying to live the American dream. a 60-year-old Korean woman with a soft perm and conservative clothes. She's taking a weekend off from pressing shirts and hemming pants at the dry cleaning business she runs with her husband. But she's not just any immigrant. She's an aunt to Kim Jong-un, the young North Korean leader who has threatened to wipe out New York City with a hydrogen bomb. And for the past 18 years, since defecting from North Korea into the waiting arms of the CIA, she has been living an anonymous life here in the United States with her husband and three children. My friends here tell me I'm so lucky that I have everything, Ko Yong-suk, as she was known when she was part of North Korea's royal family, said on a recent weekend. My kids went to great schools, and they're successful. And I have my husband who can fix anything. There's nothing we can envy. Her husband, previously known as Ri Gang, chimes in laughing. I think we have achieved the American dream. Breaking their silence in the U.S., Ko and Ri spent almost 20 hours talking to two Washington Post reporters in New York and then at their home several hours' drive away. They were nervous about emerging from their anonymity. After all, there are Americans who analyze North Korea for a living and do not even know that the couple are here. They ask that the names they use in the U.S. and their address not be published, mainly to protect their three grown children who live normal lives. Ko bears a striking resemblance to her sister, Ko Yong-hui, who was one of Kim Jong-il's wives and the mother of Kim Jong-un, the third-generation leader of North Korea. And she has a particularly close relationship with the man now considered one of the United States' top enemies. She took care of Kim Jong-un while he was at school in Switzerland. But in 1998, when Kim Jong-un was 14 and his older brother Kim Jong-chol was 17, Ko and Ri decided to defect. Ko's sister, their link to the regime, was sick with terminal breast cancer, although she did not die until 2004, and the boys were getting older. The couple apparently realized that they would not be needed by the regime much longer, and they were concerned about losing their privileged status. The Kim family has ruled North Korea for 70 years through a repressive system built on patronage and fear. They and the top cadres in the Workers' Party benefit from this system and had the most to lose if it collapses or if they run afoul of the regime. So the couple decided to flee, not to South Korea, as many North Koreans do, but to the United States. They live in a large two-story house with two cars in the driveway, a huge TV in the living room, a grill on a rear deck. They've been to Las Vegas on vacation and 2 years ago went to South Korea, where Ko enjoyed visiting the palaces she had seen in TV dramas. They look like a normal family. But look closer. That photo of her eldest son on a jet ski? It's at Wonsan, where the Kim family has its summer residence. That girl in the photo album? It's Kim Yo-jong, Kim Jong-un's younger sister, who runs the propaganda division of the Workers' Party. And the house? It was bought partly with a one-time payment of $200,000 that the CIA gave the couple on their arrival, they said. Even though Ko and Ri have not seen Kim Jong-un in almost 20 years and do not appear to have held official positions, U.S. intelligence on North Korea is so thin that this couple still represents a valuable source of information on the family court. They can reveal, for example, that Kim Jong-un was born in 1984, not 1982 or 83, as widely believed. The reason they're certain? It was the same year that their first son was born. He and my son were playmates from birth. I changed both of their diapers, Ko said with a laugh. Sometimes operatives from the CIA's National Clandestine Service come to town to show Ko and Ri photos of North Koreans and ask who the people are. The CIA declined to confirm or comment on any of Ko or Ri's claims. Some parts of the couple's history can be verified, but other parts cannot, or seem incomplete. Even today, Ri in particular is sympathetic toward the North Korean regime and is trying to get approval to visit Pyongyang. And both are careful in what they say about their powerful nephew, repeatedly referring to him as Marshal Kim Jong-un. But what they will say about their former charge paints a picture of a man who was raised knowing that he would one day be king. In 1992, Ko Yong-suk arrived in Bern, Switzerland with Kim Jong-chol, the first son of Ko's sister, and Kim Jong-il, who in 2 years would become the leader of North Korea. Kim Jong-un arrived in 1996 when he was 12. We lived in a normal house and acted like a normal family. I acted like their mother, Ko said. I encouraged him to bring his friends home because we wanted them to live a normal life. Traveling on a diplomatic passport, Ri went back and forth between North Korea and Switzerland. The family spoke Korean at home and ate Korean food, but also enjoyed the benefits of an expatriate family in an exotic locale. Ko took the Kim children to Euro Disney, now Disneyland Paris. Kim Jong-un had been to Tokyo Disneyland with his mother some years before, and Ko's photo albums are full of pictures of them skiing in the Swiss Alps, swimming on the French Riviera, eating at alfresco restaurants in Italy. Kim Jong-un loved games and machinery and trying to figure out how ships float and planes fly. He was already showing personality traits that would later become much more evident. He wasn't a troublemaker, but he was short-tempered, Ko recalled. When his mother tried to tell him off for not studying enough, he would talk back. But he would protest he wouldn't talk back, but he would protest in other ways, like going on a hunger strike. Kim loved going home for the summer, spending time in Wonsan, where his family had a huge beachfront camp compound, or at their main residence in Pyongyang, with its movie theater and plenty of room to hang out. He started playing basketball, and he became obsessed with it, his aunt said of the young Kim, who was a Michael Jordan fan. He used to sleep with his basketball. He was shorter than his friends, and his mother told him that if he played basketball, he would become taller, Ko said. The world did not know that Kim had been anointed his father's successor until October 2010, when his status was made official at a Workers' Party conference in Pyongyang. But Kim had known since 1992 that he would one day inherit North Korea. The signal was sent at his 8th birthday party, attended by North Korea's top brass, the couple said. Kim was given a general's uniform decorated with stars, and real generals with real stars bowed to him and paid their respects to him from that moment on. It was impossible for him to grow up as a normal person when the people around him were treating him like that, Ko said. From a humble background, Ko was catapulted into the top echelons of North Korean society in 1975 when her sister, a performer, caught the eye of the princeling Kim Jong-il and became his third partner. I was very close to my sister, and it was a tough job to be the wife, so she asked me to help her. She could trust me because I was her own blood, Ko said. Kim Jong-il personally selected Ri to marry his sister-in-law. They all lived in a compound in Pyongyang, with Ko looking after her sisters and her own children for years. We lived a good life, Ko said. Over a sushi lunch in New York, she reminisced about drinking cognac with sparkling water and eating caviar in Pyongyang, about riding with Kim Jong-il in his Mercedes-Benz. Then came the charmed years in Europe. But in 1998, Ko's sister discovered she had breast cancer and underwent treatment in Switzerland and France. This is where Ko and Ri's version of events starts to become opaque. Given that Ri is trying to get back into Kim Jong-un's good graces, he has reason to present their defection as nothing but altruistic. As Ri and Ko tell it, the cancer treatment in Europe was not working, So they decided they should travel to the United States to try to secure treatment for Ko's dying sister. Their defection was all about trying to save Kim Jong-un's mother, they said. Stories about the couple in the South Korean news media have suggested that they sought asylum because they were concerned about what would happen to them after Kim Jong-un's parents died. This was their link to the royal family, and without that link, what would happen to them? Ko seemed to imply that this had been a concern. In history, you often see people close to a leader getting into unintended trouble because of other people, she said. I thought it would be better if we stayed out of that kind of trouble. The dangers persist today. Just look at the case of Jang Song-thak, the uncle who also lived in the Pyongyang compound with Ko and Ri. He apparently built up too much power. In 2013, Kim had him executed. So one day in 1998, Ri and Ko and their three children took a taxi to the U.S. Embassy in Bern. They said they were North Korean diplomats and wanted asylum. After several days, they were taken to a U.S. military base near Frankfurt. They stayed in a house on the base for several months while they were questioned. It was then that Ri and Ko disclosed their family connections. The American government didn't know who Kim Jong-un was, that he would become the leader, Ri said. When they landed in the United States, the family spent a few days in the Washington area, not far from CIA headquarters, before moving to a small city where a South Korean church had offered to help them, as it had done for others who had escaped the North. The people at the church kept asking questions, Ko said, so the family moved to a different city with few other Koreans, or even other Asians. Life was hard at the beginning. We had no relatives, and we worked for 12 hours every day, Ri said. He worked as a builder, then did maintenance, jobs that were easy to do without English. Ko was frustrated at not being able to work. The only thing I could do without speaking the language was dry cleaning, she said in Korean. Ri speaks reasonable English today, but Ko's is still basic. So they opened a small store and began working long hours. Ri at the machines and Ko doing alterations. They soon hit their stride. Their children have no interest in Korea, North or South, she said. Their oldest son is a mathematician. Their second son helps out in the business, while their daughter works in computer science. They have a comfortable existence, but do not appear to be living large. Stopping at a gas station for lunch on the way back to their home, Ko is disappointed that the Dunkin' Donuts was out of burritos. It's a long way from cognac and caviar. So why are they breaking their silence now? Ri says he wants to visit North Korea and has come out of their deep cover to dispel what he calls lies being peddled about their wider family in North Korea by regime critics. He is particularly careful around reporters not to speak ill of the regime. My ultimate goal is to go back to North Korea. I understand America and I understand North Korea, so I think I can be a negotiator between the two, he said. If Kim Jong-un is how I remember he used to be, I would be able to talk to him. Ko said she misses her hometown. The pull of home cannot be underestimated in Korean culture, but does not want to go back. Nor does she want Ri to visit. But how can I change my stubborn husband's mind? This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. An obituary for you this week. The futurist who foresaw the information age. Alvin Toffler, 1928 to 2016. Half a century ago, Alvin Toffler envisioned a future of frenetic technological change that would transform human existence in both dazzling and disturbing ways. In his 1970 best-selling book Future Shock and two sequels, Toffler correctly foresaw many of the wonders of the information age, a term he coined, including the rise of a post-industrial economy based on ideas rather than things, the internet, cable TV, and the popularity of personal computers. But he also warned that the roaring current of change enabled by new technologies would lead to confusional breakdowns, manifesting in fractured families, rising crime rates, and social alienation. His prescience brought him international celebrity, but Toffler never considered himself a prophet. "I don't believe anybody knows the future," he said. "Anybody who claims to is a fraud." Born to Polish immigrants in New York City, Toffler aspired to be a writer from the time he was seven, said the New York Times. He studied English at New York University, where he met Adelaide Farrell, his future wife and editorial partner, and became involved in progressive causes, such as registering black voters. Eager for real-world experience, the couple moved to Cleveland, then at the very center of industrial America, and took factory jobs. But he still aspired to be a writer, and in 1954 was hired as a reporter by the trade magazine Industry and Welding. He returned to New York in 1959 to write for Fortune, said the Washington Post, and began immersing himself in futurist circles at the Rand Corporation, studying technology and the ways it was changing government policy, as well as home and work life. In the early 1960s, Toffler turned to freelance work. The genesis of Future Shock was a well-received 1965 article in Horizon magazine, said The Guardian. Some critics found the book and its follow-ups, the 1980s The Third Wave and 1990s Power Shift, clumsy and overheated. But Toffler was lauded on college campuses and in the corridors of power. Fans included Mexican billionaire Carlos Slim, Hugo Chavez, Mikhail Gorbachev, and Newt Gingrich. He was especially revered in Asia. The Chinese Communist Party named him one of the 50 foreigners who had done the most to affect China's development. Despite his sometimes dire warnings, Toffler embraced and celebrated change. "It is better to err on the side of daring," he said, "than on the side of caution." Here's a short business article on the news at a glance. Tech. Pokemon Go craze buoys Nintendo. Millions of smartphone-toting gamers caught Pokemon Go fever this week, sending shares of Japanese video game maker Nintendo soaring, said Takashiki Mochizuki and Sarah Needleman in the Wall Street Journal. The overnight success of the mobile gaming mega hit, which was jointly developed by Nintendo and Niantic Incorporated, and has already been downloaded more than 15 million times, pushed Nintendo's market value from $20 billion to nearly $31 billion. Pokemon Go uses a technology called augmented reality to let players hunt for and capture the game's titular pocket monsters, which can be seen through users' smartphone cameras lurking around parks, offices, and other real-world locations. Pokemon Go could be the moment augmented reality breaks through from a niche toy for early adopters to something much bigger, said Nick Wingfield and Mike Isaac in the New York Times. Many expected the technology, which lays digital imagery over a person's view of the real world, to take off through business applications. For example, allowing an architect to visualize a finished building project while it's still under construction. Instead, it took a game based on a beloved entertainment franchise from the mid-1990s in Japan to help the technology go mainstream. And on the health and science page, the ozone hole, healing at last. The hole in the Earth's protective ozone layer, once a defining issue of the environmental movement, is finally starting to shrink, new research reveals. Encircling the globe in the stratosphere, the ozone layer is a gaseous shield that absorbs the bulk of the sun's ultraviolet radiation. But in 1974, two University of California chemists sounded a dire alarm. Chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, chemicals once widely used in everything from aerosol spray bottles to air conditioners, were accumulating in the upper atmosphere, which has a finite capacity for absorbing chlorine atoms. Over the next decade, CFCs went on to bore a hole in the ozone layer above Antarctica. The hole opens every year in August and is generally deepest in October. The damage was expected to worsen over time, exposing people, animals, and crops to increasing amounts of harmful UV rays, with potentially catastrophic consequences. Despite fierce opposition from the chemical industry, a 1987 international treaty known as the Montreal Protocol led to the phasing out of CFCs and several other ozone-depleting gases. The strategy worked. A team at MIT has found that the hole opens later in the year and isn't as deep as it used to be. In addition, it has shrunk by 1.5 million square miles and is on pace to close entirely by mid-century. It's been quite a remarkable history, study leader Susan Solomon tells NationalGeographic.com. It gives us hope that we shouldn't be afraid to tackle large environmental problems. And the health scare of the week, stem cell snake oil. Beware of stem cell therapy scams, a new study warns. So far, the Food and Drug Administration has approved only one stem cell product for sale, Hemacord, which treats certain blood disorders. But that hasn't kept some 350 companies at 570 locations across the U.S. from marketing costly and unregulated stem cell therapies directly to patients and their families. After conducting an exhaustive internet search, a team of researchers found businesses advertising a vast range of treatments that haven't been scientifically proven safe or effective. The products include everything from facelift treatments to treatments for autism and devastating degenerative diseases like arthritis, Alzheimer's, and multiple sclerosis. California leads the pack with a total of 113 stem cell dispensing clinics, but in every single state there are stem cell therapies available that haven't been approved or fully vetted by the FDA. These are pretty dramatic claims for treating ALS for Parkinson's, University of Minnesota bioethicist Lee Turner tells The Guardian. And when you look, is there an experienced stem cell researcher there? No. Is there any record of previous research trials? No. They're basically operating off the grid. On the Talking Points page, gun rights, a good guy fantasy exposed. An armed society is a polite society. That's one of the National Rifle Association's favorite slogans, said Evan Osnos in NewYorker.com. But over 48 blood-soaked hours last week, the poisonous flaw in that fantasy was exposed from multiple angles. Both Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, the black men shot dead by the police in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Falcon Heights, Minnesota, were carrying guns for their own protection. Yet rather than making these men safer, as per NRA dogma, their weapons frightened police officers and led to the men's deaths. The subsequent killings in Dallas highlighted the folly of the NRA's belief in good guys with guns, said the Washington Post in an editorial. As one bad guy with an assault weapon shot 12 armed cops, Five fatally frantic police had to contend with the fact that about 30 protesters were carrying rifles under Texas open carry law. How many shooters were there? Police couldn't tell. Gun-toting civilians fed the confusion and amped up the danger. The deaths of Sterling and Castillo show that the Second Amendment does not apply to black Americans, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. The NRA, which usually defends anyone punished for exercising this Second Amendment rights, belatedly described Castillo's death as troubling, but declined further comment. No surprise there. Ever since the Reconstruction era, white Americans haven't wanted black people to share the right to bear arms. When Black Panthers took advantage of California's open carry laws in the 1960s, that state and others immediately adopted gun control legislation. Thanks to the NRA, the nation is now flooded with guns, said Adam Gopnik in NewYorker.com. Police must do their jobs in constant fear of being shot. Add toxic race relations to that mix, and it pretty much guarantees a constant drumbeat of tragic deaths. In Dallas, another of the gun rights movement's central myths was exposed, said Joshua Holland in The Nation. Americans must have access to military-style weapons, armor-piercing bullets, and high-capacity magazines, the NRA says, to enable citizens to take up arms against a tyrannical government running amok. That's precisely what Micah Johnson thought he was doing, waging war on police, abusing their power. Instead of saving the nation from tyranny, our gun laws have once again empowered a disturbed loner to commit a bloody mass murder, this time of cops who were just doing their jobs. And we'll finish with a quote from Arthur Miller. He says, "There is nothing further away from Washington than the entire world." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.